This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
In this podcast edition of the essay, John Dethridge discusses Wagner and Theodor Adorno.
The Scottish sociologist Donald Macrae once noted in a crusty 1974 review of Theodor Adorno's book Negative Dialectics that in the Anglophone world, the cultural presuppositions of the Frankfurt School, or Frankfurters as he liked to call them, are too alien, too rich, and too deceiving for that dialect to be learnt as genuine speech. To be a disciple of Frankfurt in 1974 in South London or Newcastle, he wrote, is as silly as trying to be a Viking or an imperial Chinese bureaucrat. This feeling about Adorno and the Frankfurters still didn't go away many years later, even for Germans. Hans-Werner Henze wrote in his autobiography that during a performance of Wagner's Götterdämmerung, conducted by Karajan in Vienna, he bumped into Adorno with a copy of the thick green study score under his arm. But I really couldn't abide him, especially since the day he'd insisted on singing some of his Lieder to me, accompanying himself on the piano in his flat in Frankfurt, where the furnishings were dominated by crochet work covers. In a series of reminiscences about Adorno, the German music critic Joachim Kaiser, though careful not to downplay him as a petty bourgeois professor and composer manqué like Henze did, still pointed to weaknesses hard to overlook. Adorno's notorious vanity was a protective device, but one that also made him vulnerable, Kaiser claimed. Adorno wanted to be loved by everyone, even by those he personally disliked. The vanity and masochistic narcissism extended to other so-called Frankfurters as well. Adorno is well known for his association with thinkers like Max Horkheimer, Walter Benjamin and Herbert Marcuse, who developed a body of critical theory, derived mainly from Hegel, Marx and Freud, that excoriated the modern world as a dark place where only a faint sliver of hope in redemption can exist. Adorno in particular often sounded like a demonic theologian with a black dog collar. According to him, society hasn't just become less rational and economically productive, as Marx said it would, but radically evil. If we assume that art relates to our world, therefore, it has to be about this truth. There can be no such thing anymore as affirmative art, no more happy endings, beautiful surfaces, or glowing responses. Any such thing is tantamount to moral failure. Adorno's message didn't make him popular, of course, and it still doesn't. But his criticism of what he called culture industry strikes a chord even today. That is, the blandishments of mass media determined to inveigle us into thinking that we live in a positive and ever-improving world. Unusually for philosophers, even Frankfurters, Adorno placed music at the centre of his ideas. Nearly half his books are devoted to music, one of the most important of which is about Wagner. No wonder Henze bumped into Adorno with the score of Götterdämmerung tucked under his arm. In Adorno's way of thinking, Wagner was the glorious beginning of the end, a great musician whose mythology reflected the iconic world of a crumbling empire with its eclectic architecture, fake Gothic design, and the aggressive dream symbols of the new German boom from the Bavarian castles of Ludwig II and their flourishing tourist industry to the Berlin restaurant calling itself Das Rheingold. Or more generally, the descent of high culture into postmodernism, the freezing of the world into a static space where art is pulverized into dead, alluring surfaces and time is stopped in its tracks to become a meaningless repetition of the same. According to Adorno, this is what Wagner is really about. His book on Wagner was conceived in the late 1930s and published in 1952. But its importance has been overshadowed by the perception that the few upfront remarks he devoted to Wagner's anti-Semitism in its first chapter fanned the flames of the notorious controversy about the composer that still rages today. But that really wasn't its aim at all. Adorno described it in the 1950s and 60s more than once as a rescue, an attempt to wrest what's left of Wagner's humanity from the forces of history that threaten to engulf him, by which he meant the entanglement of Wagner's reputation with Nazi ideology. The seemingly negative turn of the book has led many of its critics to mistake it for a polemical tract. Even the title of the English translation doesn't help. In German, the book's called Versuch über Wagner, and in English, In Search of Wagner. But the German word Versuch reflects the notion of something a bit more scientific and rigorous, the sense of a text or experiment. And it refers to the book's method, not to any tentative seeking out of one of the world's most controversial cultural figures. The dedication to Adorno's wife Gretel, the marvellous epigraph Horses are the Survivors of Heroes, and references to Walter Benjamin and Max Horkheimer suggest immediately that Adorno isn't interested in polemics or Proustian fastidiousness. He's definitely not in search of Wagner. On the contrary, he claims from the outset not only to have found him, warts and all, but with an almost Wagnerian act of redemption to have saved him as well. The reader's unlikely to make much sense of the Essay on Wagner, as the book should be called in English, without some knowledge of its sociological premise. Briefly, Adorno believes that the modern era is ruled by a contradictory use of reason. On the one hand, the use of reason enables human beings to gain control over their natural environment, to make it available for positive ends. On the other hand, the use of reason enables human beings to gain control over other human beings, to make them available for negative ends, which is to say, the dominance of social rulers. Both these progressive and reactionary tendencies are intertwined. The yearning for happiness in a world of increasing wealth and knowledge is frustrated by regressive interests that drive the intellect into narrow, specialised areas. The more individuals are compartmentalised, in other words, the more they're alienated and susceptible to manipulation. The only hope of reconciliation is a critical awareness of this destructive contradiction and the use of pure theory as passive resistance against conformity. Adorno sees Wagner as a heavily damaged bourgeois individual whose weaknesses are so great and whose capitulation to the forces of reaction is so complete that his very decadence becomes a critical weapon against the powers he allegedly serves. Adorno arrives at this observation after passing through some intriguing dialectical constructions based on a virtuoso use of analogy. Surprisingly, perhaps, he's not interested in the subject of Hitler and Bayreuth, nor does he dwell on proto-fascist traits in Wagner's personality in order to revive the silly cliché that Wagner was a Nazi. Rather, his aim is to offset his sociological premise about the positive and negative uses of reason in society with internal analyses of Wagner's actual music that trace the historical dynamic of the so-called era of bourgeois decline. Instead of identifying Wagner with Nazism, Adorno tries to illuminate the distance between them, the deep descent from the primeval landscape of fascism in the 19th century to the most barbaric recesses of the 20th. The heart of Adorno's book is the chapter on phantasmagoria. This highly involved concept, which Adorno developed with Benjamin in the 1930s, is centred on an analogy between the commodity and the work of art. An important constituent of Wagner's works, Adorno believes, is the elimination in their outward appearance of the human labour involved in their production. Social work, including the act of composing, is effectively disguised and dangled magically before the listener as if it were a wholesome product of nature, like the orchestral passage in Siegfried known as Forest Murmurs. Adorno defines phantasmagoria technically as diminution, the thinning out of orchestral sound, static harmonies, or the pianissimi that are in fact oral images of loudness heard from afar. The music subjected to a vertical and horizontal process of shrinking that creates the impression of endless space, and with it an allegory of the eternal and the mythical. The listener, isolated by society's divisive mode of production, takes refuge in this mirage of eternity. Moreover, it appears to offer him or her pleasure, just as Venus offers the delights of her world to Tannhäuser, only to denounce pleasure as sickness and to confuse the two as if they were the same thing.
It even embraces social criticism. But opera producers who see, say, Beckmesser or Mime, as negative comments on the capitalist division of labour are deceiving themselves. These parodies of social alienation and deformity are for Adorno part of the illusion. Wagner's Phantasmagoria pretends to be aware of social evil and thereby creates an alibi for itself, which, instead of helping to abolish that evil, actually intensifies it by salving the bad conscience of the observer with an entertaining experience that's incapable of giving any true insight into the problem it presents. The medium of Phantasmagoria is the Gesamtkunstwerk, or total work of art. With this concept, Wagner achieved a division of labour unprecedented in the history of music. His attempt to disguise this fact, Adorno insists, is the dialectical root of music drama. On the one hand, the total work of art is a modern piece of technological wizardry involving an intricate combination of disparate elements and requiring a huge collective effort to produce. On the other hand, its creator deliberately blurs the borderline between its individual components and their modes of production in order to create a replica of a society freed from the ills of capitalism and technology. Adorno shows, quite correctly, how the rationale of Wagner's working methods enabled him to interlock disparate layers of music drama in order to make them seem cohesive and immediate. Adorno also points out, however, that Wagner's division of labour isn't truly collective, but that of the individual whose origins and substance are rooted in the self-same alienation against which the total work of art rebels. Wagner's attempt to combine the arts is therefore a failure in the end. The substance of his work, the metaphysics of yearning, rapture and redemption, rules out collective labour just as his social situation does. This is why, instead of using the antithetical nature of the arts productively, he's forced to mix them into an opaque brew and to destroy their real identity. The apparently seamless form of music drama robs music of its decisive power and turns Wagner's truly humanistic demand for a whole and free society into its opposite, intoxication and delusion. But the ending of Adorno's book is also a happy ending. Wagner's art, he explains, ultimately breaks through the illusions it creates. Brunhilde's horse is a silent, compassionate animal that evokes memories of a bygone age with a power of faith lacking in our own. That black, jagged music in the third act of Tristan makes us aware that the whole power of love has turned into its antithesis in the world in which we live. With Tristan's curse on love, Wagner unmasks the deceptive vision of Phantasmagoria. The language of his works is at the service of a social order, against which, nonplussed, he finally turns. He voices the fears of helpless people, which makes it only logical that in later life he became increasingly preoccupied with the hopeless half-beings his music wants to rescue. Goethe's Mignon, the nymphs in Fouquet's Undina stories, the Rhine daughters, and the flower maidens. If Orpheus could curb Hades with the power of music, Adorno is saying, there's a precious element in Wagner's music too that could renew the promise contained in this age-old protest, the promise of a life without fear. Still, no one seriously interested in Wagner can afford to ignore Adorno's astonishing book. Its influence distinguished artists and scholars, including Wieland Wagner, the film director Hans-Jürgen Sieberberg, and the musicologist Karl Dahlhaus. And it probably did more than any other single publication to clear the Wagnerian air in Germany after the Second World War. In a sense, Adorno is trying literally to face the music. There's something embarrassingly unresolved in Wagner's public image and a sinister element in his works that'll never vanish. It's foolish to equate him with Nazism, but it's equally foolish to ignore the mechanisms of history that have implicated him more than any other major figure of the 19th century in events of unspeakable horror. It's in order to overcome this almost insurmountable barrier, Adorno is suggesting, that we must confront Wagner in a rational way that distances us from his repellent social character, while at the same time bringing us closer to his music and what we still feel is important about it.